so to speak on that, I'm very pleased to introduce my colleague, Matthew Cowan, from the Institute of the Environment. Matt is also cross-appointed to the Department of Economics here and the Public Policy School. And he is an economist who works on issues of the environment. He wrote a book called Green Cities about urban growth and the environment. He has another book coming out, Climatopolis, and has a very, very broad view and a synthetic approach, and I think will give us a very, very interesting follow-up then to the science literature from the economic, historical, and social approach. So, Matthew Cowan.
Thank you. Glenn, thank you very much. Oh. Richard's talk feeds very nicely into what I'm going to do. He scared me a little on a number of dimensions. I've been nominated to be a lead author in the next edition of the IPCC, and now I see there's no free lunch and 3 years of my life. We'll have to talk about this. There's benefits and costs of any action. Richard covered a bunch of these, but let's do these quickly, and I have 26 slides I'd like to show you, most related to my research, and I'll be able to cover some of the themes Glenn mentioned, but it's I'm going to try to be modest and focus on what I know. So to come back to what Richard said, a key theme in my work is I'm an environmental economist and an urban economist, and I'm fascinated by the idea that the rise of cities have caused climate change. If we'd all remained farmers, would we really face climate change today? And look at Jared Diamond's algebra. I won't put this on Jared Diamond, but Jared Diamond is always writing down the Paul Ehrlich formula that we get a heck of a lot of greenhouse gas emissions if there's a lot of us, if we have a lot of income, and if our carbon emissions per dollar of output is very high. So imagine if there were 7 billion people on the planet, each driving a Hummer 12,000 miles a year. I once calculated that was in the trillions when I did the arithmetic. And that's the American dream gone wild. Be careful what you wish for. If there were 7 billion of us, each living large, the American, in a Hummer of the total scale of our economy. When I teach environmental economics to our students, the first two terms, urbanization can help to reduce a nation's population size. It certainly raises the per capita income level. Our only hope that cities can be a friend of mitigating carbon is if they accelerate technological advance and diffusion through reducing the E in that equation. So to repeat Richard's point, and I agree with him 100%, if we're serious about mitigating carbon and putting on my economics hat, we can either knock off some people, and there's ways, we both are fans of birth control and raising women's opportunities around the world, this sort of quantity-quality trade-off of encouraging women's opportunities outside the household can very quickly reduce population growth. Capitalism does lead to per capita income growth. When we live in cities, we're richer. We can trade with each other. Compare Robinson Crusoe to Matt Kahn. When I live in LA, I can delegate all of my consumption, whether it's Starbucks coffee or dry cleaning, welcome, and I can do the one thing I'm relatively good at, my comparative advantage, cracking bad economics lectures. And cities allow us to specialize, and specialization is the key to income growth. Now, our best chance is technological advance and diffusion, and I'll be coming back to that, a major theme in modern economics. As Richard said, the two big ideas, to me, in the policy of climate change are issues regarding mitigation. How do we achieve Jim Hansen's goal of capping greenhouse gases at 350 parts per million? And Richard's graphs were scary. I saw a linear trend. And we can talk at the policy. We can talk about public policies to reverse that, and I will in about two slides. I'm also going to talk at length today in my last seven slides about adaptation. While I would love for my son to grow up in a world where we have capped greenhouse gas emissions, due to free rider reasons and issues I'll be talking about in a moment, I'm pessimistic that we're going to be able to cap our greenhouse gas emissions. Climate change is coming. And with it, there's interesting issues of when you know that a challenge is coming in the future, are you fatalistic and just take it on the chin? Or are we forward-looking, rational individuals who, when we anticipate, that, like the Titanic, that we're approaching an iceberg, do we change the ship? Do we take steps to head to higher ground? Are we proactive at protecting ourselves when we anticipate change? And that's going to be what I'm going to talk about in my last 7 slides. Folks, who am I? I'm not a macroeconomist. I fight wars against macroeconomists. I'm a microeconomist in the Freakonomics tradition. That was supposed to be a joke. Of everything I do is collecting funky data sets, as I'll be showing you in a couple of minutes, and doing very basic statistics to come up with stuff that no one's thought about before. I write it up on my blog, the Wall Street Journal writes it up, and you get a paper. It's a very nice world of being sort of a public and academic intellectual revolving around empirical hypothesis testing. So here's what I'm going to do. I'd like to tell you about 3 different projects of mine. All of, and I can read minds. If these don't interest you, we will just get right to questions. The first project I want to talk about is the failure at Copenhagen, my work on the political economy of who voted in favor of the Waxman-Markey bill on mitigating carbon in June 2009. I'm then going to show you how I've gone about ranking carbon footprints in China cities. And then I'm going to talk about my new book that Glenn alluded to, of how different cities around the world, which cities will win and lose in the face of climate change. Should you be selling short your Los Angeles real estate and buying in Fargo right now? Where are the opportunities? That climate change, a theme in my work, is that urban places will suffer from climate change, but urban people don't have to in a world of migration and choice. And we can debate this, and there's many contentious issues. Folks, let's start with the first issue. The voting on greenhouse gas mitigation, and Richard covered several of these, so we can pick up speed. The U.S. and China produce 50% of our carbon emissions. The issue to an economist is think of Governor Schwarzenegger, and I don't want to hear about his hydrogen Hummer. When he revs up that Hummer of his, he creates greenhouse gas emissions that exacerbate the global externality. But he has no individual incentive to unilaterally reduce his greenhouse gas emissions. The problem is the atmosphere is common property, and no one has, except for a very good person, and I'm sure there's good people in this room, but most people whom I teach economics lectures to are not good people. There's many people who need an incentive to not produce carbon. And we collectively have been very slow to adopt the carbon tax or a price on carbon to reduce our carbon emissions. I've been fascinated by the question of whether the United States will step up and lead a coalition of the willing to battle climate change. Folks, a map. My co-author Kevin Gurney of the Vulcan Project at Purdue. This is the United States. This is data from the year 2002. The whiter you are, don't ask about the scale, the whiter a state is, its per capita carbon emissions are lower. The darker are your states, the higher your carbon emissions. It's best not to record this. Folks, what do you see? What do you see in Nancy Pelosi's state?
White people?
I see on the liberal coast, so you can't tell me a theory of geographical determinism. There's interesting issues. So there's 2 questions. First, there's a descriptive question. What do you see? But then a more important question to an ambitious social scientist is why? Why are the coasts have such lower carbon footprints than what I see with West Virginia and Missouri? A question in my recent research has been, what's going on? My co-author Ed Glazer has argued that it is geographic determinism, that California just has better weather, and this allows us to not crank the air conditioning. We have access to ample natural gas, and this allows us to not have coal-fired power plants. But then I show Glazer this picture. Folks, this is funny and interesting. Let me make sure everyone can read it. Time goes from 1960 to the year 2000. On the vertical axis is electricity consumption per capita. Somehow we have several red lines. California is the bottom, is the triangle line. Does everyone see that California's electricity consumption per capita rises till 1972 and then is flat ever after? That's good news in terms of capping greenhouse gas emissions if we're producing electricity with natural gas or other fossil fuels. Compare that to Republican states, the red line. Does everyone see the divergence, that the Republicans are the squares? Does everyone see the divergence between the Democrats and Republicans? Folks, does everyone see the divergence between the blue states, which are the diamonds, and the red states, which are the squares? And of course, the United States is a weighted average of these. And so, Californians, hold your liberal heads high. While this line has not come down, at least you see this divergence. In the year 2002, California's electricity consumption is 40% lower than the rest of the nation. What have we done right? A brilliant physicist named Art Rosenfeld says it's good public policy. And he wants to point to the California Energy Commission and policies enacted by the state. Republicans come back and say, no, no, no. With your high electricity prices, you've scared off all your dirty manufacturing. And so there's a very interesting intellectual debate going on. When you see California is green, is this due to wise public policy, and or how much is due to these deflection effects of dirty energy-intensive industry moving to domestic pollution havens, moving to Nevadas and other states that have lower energy prices? So this curve has fascinated me, because if it's truly our public policy, then other states could adopt that as we seek out ways to address Richard's point of how we cap our emissions. But back to this picture. What Mike Craig and I, am I happy about this? Mike Craig, a guy who we were colleagues at Columbia University together, we wanted to know which congressmen vote in favor of bills like Waxman-Markey. In June 2009, the U.S. Congress voted on whether, and voted by just a couple, a majority did, and the Senate has not ratified this, the Congress voted on legislation to address Richard's points. What Craig and I did in our study was posit the following three dimensions. Folks, why did Nancy Pelosi vote yes? She voted yes because she's from a low-carbon state, from a rich district, and she's liberal. Flip that around. What vote does President Obama not get? If in West Virginia there is a poor community with a conservative representative, coming back to Richard's point about inconvenient truth, if you're from a district which is high carbon, which has a Republican, has a conservative representative, and your district is poor, you vote against this legislation. And so we have a polarized country. I'll say this again, because I'm not saying this as well as I'd wished. It is easy to build a carbon coalition off of liberal, rich, low-carbon areas, but there's not a majority of those votes. So, folks, if there's sort of Henry Kissinger, real politique people in the room, how do you build a coalition? How do you build a majority coalition? We need side payments. And so there's interesting issues of how you make, basically, if California wants West Virginia's senators and congresspeople to vote in favor of this legislation, there needs to be side payments. And it's a sort of an awkward political science issue of how, I'm not saying vote buying, but of how you transfer resources to build this majority coalition. So a fundamental challenge we environmentalists face is, in a democratic system, how do you build a majority coalition? I would hope that Richard's PowerPoint, if he took that to Dick Cheney, if he took that into West Virginia and put it on, I would hope they would invite you. But if he put on that, if he put on his talk, is anyone at the margin who could be swayed, or does this come down to writing a check? And so with cap and trade, for those of you who followed some of the issues, a major issue was giving the electric utilities who were creating the pollution, giving them free allocations of these permits, which is implicitly a handout, rather than auctioning them off and the government keeping the revenue. And so unfortunately, due to my work with Craig, I am pessimistic, this second bullet point, for carbon-intensive, poor, conservative areas, the Obama administration is going to have to think hard about how to build a coalition. And what I find scary as an economist is, without cap-and-trade legislation, without a price on releasing greenhouse gas emissions, Richard's algebra goes through. U.S. Greenhouse gas emissions will just continue to rise, and China and India's will too. Folks, I mentioned that I'm very interested in this picture. I think a question that all Californians should ask is, what have we done right as a state to explain why California was able to slow down our rise in greenhouse gas emissions activity. I think this is a very optimistic picture. And so in my own work, I've studied a bunch of things, a little bit of the microeconomics. I have studied the propensity of who purchases Prius vehicles, highly fuel-efficient vehicles, who installs solar panels into their homes. And these are very simple statistical models that won't shock you. People who are relatively well-to-do, educated, and liberal are more likely to purchase these products and to walk the walk. And so when, if I may crack a half joke, I was talking to my old teachers at the University of Chicago, and I come from a libertarian tradition, and I am the intellectual son of several Nobel laureates. I expect to win a Nobel Prize. These guys said, Matt, this is terrific. You're studying who's an environmentalist. And they said, Matt, you're going to write a paper called Hypocrites. So what? And they said, you're going to show, Matt, that there are people who vote green, but then like Al Gore have a big carbon footprint and don't walk the walk. And when I studied this, my old teachers were wrong. There in California, there's an internal consistency that people who vote green in terms of local referenda and voting, they walk the walk in terms of walking to work, using public transit, purchasing Priuses, having solar panels. And so I found that internal consistency of environmentalists in both the public and private arena interesting. Broke the heart of my Chicago teachers, but I'm no longer a kid. And that's and I am now here. I'm now working for the electric utility SMUD, and I think this is worth 2 minutes, of the microeconomics of this picture. I'm sorry. SMUD is up in Sacramento, and it's a highly progressive electric utility. They want more of their households purchasing green power. What green power is you pay a fee of $6 a month, and all of your power comes from renewables. Has anyone here signed up for LADWP's program? So I could ask Stephanie, did you have to think hard about this, or was it a no-brainer?
Well, actually, it was the solar panel from our group.
And so a question to the audience, what share of Sacramento's service area has signed up for this program? 94%? 1%? 8%. SMUD has approached me and said, fancy professor, can you do better? I said, yeah. And then I had to sit down and think. What they're going to let me do and what we're getting ready to send out in the field is a randomized experiment to encourage more households to sign up for green power, because SMUD's carbon footprint would be smaller if more households sign up. So we have several ideas. This is UCLA Research in Progress. We've randomized four different treatments. For one group, we're going to randomly give them a bumper sticker. Folks, why would a bumper sticker set which says, I signed up for green power? If you receive that if you sign up, why might that increase your probability of signing up? You can show off that you're green. So hypothesis number one is that green consumer behavior is about showing off. It's sort of a Veblen keeping up with the Joneses. Why has the Prius taken off? Thesis number two is to tell people what share of their neighbors have signed up and to say 33% of your neighbors have already signed up. So sort of another, we're going to randomly determine whether we give that information, and that is information of what your peers are up to. In a third experiment, and perhaps this is cheating, we're going to tell people if you sign up now, we're going to give you 2 free months. This is an opt-in program. This is an opt-in program where you have to opt in whether you want to participate. We're going to give households 2 free months and see if we can, if they participate. And there is a literature in economics on status quo bias, that whatever is the status quo, you then don't drop out. So if we can lure them to sign in, then after 2 months pass, a rational University of Chicago agent should drop out. Say, thank you for the 2 free months. But we think that these folks, out of inertia bias, will just stay on the program. And so we can discuss if the ends justify the means. I do think that one thing that has gone right in California is that there's less free riding in this state, that there's more sophistication about environmental issues and a greater willingness to sacrifice than in other parts of the country. And I think we should be proud of that, even if there's others who might say you guys are suckers. And this is an issue that has arisen in discussing ongoing environmental regulation. I'm going to skip my picture of Priuses, but we can come back to that in the question and answers of my work on where are the most Prius registrations in the state of California. Folks, they're in Malibu. And one fact, the ratio of Priuses in Berkeley's zip code to Westwood, what is the ratio of Priuses in Berkeley's zip code to Westwood? Same ethnic distribution, same income distribution, same educational distribution. 6-1. And so, interesting stuff. Folks, before I talk about adaptation, I want to talk about California's AB 32. Mary Nichols, who was the director of the Institute of the Environment, now has a very important job as the chair of the Air Resources Board. She has been, in the year 2006, Governor Schwarzenegger signed this very macho legislation, committing, it comes back to one of Richard's graphs, committing California to an 80% reduction below the year 1990s levels by the year 2050. It sort of resembles one of Richard's ski slopes. Now, no economist is smart enough to know what the impact of this would be on the economy. I've been a supporter of this legislation for two reasons, and there's a big fight going on in economics on the costs and benefits of this legislation. I am a big believer in the guinea pig effect. The greatness of capitalism, and capitalism has many weaknesses. There's income inequality, there's dislocation, but a greatness of capitalism is this innovation feature. We end up with new products, whether it's the iPad or iPod or PowerPoint or Diet Coke or baldness medicine. Capitalism is always innovating. If we want a greener capitalism, we need to focus the engine of innovation on greening the economy. To Governor Schwarzenegger and Mary Nichols' credit, they are trying to create a big push. It's a commitment mechanism. California is saying, we're going to be green. Venture capitalists and future Googles out there, if you want a piece of the green economy, you want access to California's consumers, you want access to California's universities, there's going to be the tax credits and incentives to build a green economy here. And of course the hope, this is not out of altruism, the hope is to get the next Silicon Valley or the next Wall Street or the next Hollywood here. The challenge is free riding, and we can come back to this in the questions and answers, but there's been a debate among economists of whether California is providing almost volunteer service for the rest of the world. The world will gain from California's AB 32, but California taxpayers may face higher prices for electricity and paying for subsidies because of this legislation. But I think it is a green good deed. Folks, in the name of time, I'm going to do this section very quickly. A piece of my recent research is, where would Al Gore want you to live? So I said at the start that we're all living in cities. Why is it intuitive to you that Al Gore would not want us in Houston? If all of Americans lived in a Houston-type city, we'd be driving everywhere, cranking the air conditioning. In our sprawl city, land prices would be low, and we would have a big house that would need electricity. And to offset the humidity, we would be firing up these coal-fired power plants to produce our power. So we know that Houston is not the right answer. But where would Al Gore want us to live? My answer is basically in a New York City-style density, but in a city like Los Angeles or San Francisco. And so I'm very interested in land use regulation and how do we build cities of much higher density now that crime is down. Now that people feel safer in cities, if we had better public schools of how you get families with children back into living at high density. And so a major theme in my recent work is to reimagine our cities. Just because we've built sprawled suburbs and the American dream has been about your own house up till now, doesn't mean it has to be that way moving forward. And so I continue to talk to urban planners of how we combine housing policy with transportation policy to build very different cities that have a much smaller carbon footprint. In work with some Chinese co-authors, and I'm going to skip this in the name of time, but I want to show you one thing. China is building major cities today. Hundreds of millions of people are deciding what cities to live in. There's interesting issues both in the United States and in China of, if from a carbon mitigation point of view, what cities do we want to grow? And folks, to jump to my answer, here's China, and what I want everyone to see, this is 74 cities in China that me and my co-authors ranked with respect to their carbon footprint. And intuitively, here's the thought experiment. We took an average Chinese household, standardized by household income and demographics, and we asked, what would be their carbon footprint? meeting, what would be their greenhouse gas emissions from transportation, electricity consumption, and heating if they lived in each of 74 different cities. So folks, here's the thought experiment. Suppose we're a family. Pick us up and put us in Shanghai. What's our carbon footprint? Pick us up, move us to Beijing with the same income, same demographics. What's our carbon footprint? An apples-to-apples comparison. For those of you who don't know China, it would be as if I picked us up, put us in Atlanta, Houston, San Francisco. Which city has the smallest footprint? To cut to the chase, the smaller a circle you are, the smaller is your standardized footprint. Folks, notice that the biggest carbon footprint are in the cities in the north. What's going on? China's north is cold. Home heating comes from burning coal. Coal is a high carbon fuel. What's gone wrong, and so point number one, is the cities that are more to the north have a larger carbon footprint. Folks, if you said, Matt, why is this interesting? I actually have a decent answer to that one. These rankings of cities' carbon emissions are useful for understanding the unintended environmental consequences of government policies. Folks, the Chinese state is powerful. The Chinese state, until recently, in the recent past, China has been focused on exports, and it is focused on its eastern cities and building those up. But in the name of reducing income inequality, the state has changed its focus to actually encouraging the growth in certain regions, like in northern China's cities. Economists are fascinated by unintended consequences. An unintended consequence of encouraging northern city growth is that you actually increase the nation's greenhouse gas emissions. Al Gore would much prefer that these cities grow. But since the Chinese government is not fixated on its sole criteria for how it chooses regional development policies is not solely based on greenhouse gas emissions, it's implicit subsidies. It's building power plants, highways, giving welfare funds. These types of policies encourage the growth in the high carbon areas. But something optimistic, though. When I presented this in China, a young lady in the room said, Professor, you're right, but you're wrong. She said that off the map is Russia to the north of China, and that a natural gas pipeline is being built. And so while many young environmental students say globalization is bad, it leads to the pollution haven hypothesis, and start to chant that we can't have any more trade, one always has to think through intended and unintended consequences. Yes, today northern cities in China are relying on coal, but if a natural gas pipeline from Russia is built and goes into northern China, that emissions factor could fall sharply. People would still need heating services, but if it came from natural gas rather than coal. I think as we begin to battle climate change, we need to think through the status quo and can we do better? And so if China's government did face a carbon incentive, natural gas is 50% cleaner than coal. If China did enact a carbon incentive, there would be strong incentives for the northern cities to be like California and to switch to natural gas, and those big circles would shrink in terms of their carbon footprint. And so there's a difference between social science and physics, and that's what I meant by a law of physics. Final topic. I always try to be ahead of the curve, and terrific, brilliant scholars are in deep thought about mitigation issues. I am always seeking out how to compete in this academic setting, and I always run away from competition. Recognizing how many scholars are in deep thought about climate change mitigation, I've been thinking harder and harder about adaptation. And Basic Books, a serious press who I've had a terrific experience with, will publish this book in the fall. And you can't see the subtitle. You can see what you want to see in this cover. I saw like that Beatles song, Here Comes the Sun. Other people see an apocalypse. And I found that interesting. And so the title I wanted was Climatopolis, The Future of Our Cities in a Hotter World. That title has been changed, and I'm not happy about this. But let me set this up. As shown by the events in Copenhagen, and Richard had the pictures, that there was no food, and I won't ask about the toilets. There will continue to be a fundamental challenge. Greenhouse gas emissions are just going to keep rising. Given international free riding and the fundamental tragedy of the commons, that we all own the atmosphere, we got to get ready for climate change. And this says, are our cities doomed? It's very important. Well, let me set this up. What? Did something just happen? One of the reasons I wrote this up as a book is because empirical economists, the future is the future. And I am not Isaac Asimov or Ray Bradbury. You can't publish stuff in peer review. I once talked to Richard about this. Economists have trouble publishing predictions about the future because they're not falsifiable. And so you can make predictions given historical data and predict forward. But it's very challenging in a peer review context to write about the future. And yet I have many ideas about our future. So what did I do? I subverted the whole peer review process. And that's the beauty of writing a book that's a popular book, but that will intellectually challenge many. And folks, if you want to read a serious peer-reviewed paper that I wrote that's generating a lot of attention, that's the intellectual underpinnings of this book, please read Urban Growth and Climate Change. And that's on my webpage. The book's core thesis. Cities have caused climate change. And I hope I don't need to reiterate that. I believe that. And I believe in the science of climate change. But urbanization will actually protect us from climate change impacts. This book is an optimistic book. So if the publisher had to turn me, and we have to be careful here, there's a fine line between optimism and extreme optimism. I am not a doom and gloomer about how our cities will respond to climate change. That's distinct, and I'm going to be very clear in a moment. And so this book is about when we foresee challenges, our ability to adapt and to make choices that protect us. And I think the right way to do this in a concise time, let's do it like this, since this is controversial. In the case of Arnold Schwarzenegger and his Hummer, when he doesn't drive that Hummer, that's sort of, he's doing a good deed for society. But when climate change starts to approach, and so when the climate change scientists start to talk about drought, when they start to talk about heat waves, when they talk about pollution, when they talk about fires, folks, will you and your family keep living your life the way you did? A rational family will change their behavior. And a simple example, if you live on a San Diego coast that may flood, yes, your home will decline in value, but you have a series of strategies to protect your family against risk. There is an architect here at UCLA who is designing with Brad Pitt floatable homes. And so this was written up by UCLA. Thomas Mann, does anyone know him? He's an architect here, anticipating that climate change will cause more flooding and that there will be a demand for our homes to be more resilient when climate shocks occur. Do we just keep living our lives in cruddy buildings like this one? No. We start to redesign our products and we start to redesign our cities. I'm not a fatalist. Taking every word of the climate science is true, but forming expectations of the future, I think that men and women have the right incentives to think through how to save their own ass. And individually, this self-interest, which is such a dirty word in the year 2010, self-interest will actually protect us against many of climate change's impacts. And so I talk at length in the book about the Titanic versus climate change. And let's spend 1 minute there, but I'm eyeing the clock. In the case of the Titanic, the iceberg was spotted and there was no time to turn the ship. Climate change scientists are giving us leading indicators of what's occurring to our climate. Different households can process that information. There will be some households who will ignore that information and call people like Richard a Chicken Little. But if you're a risk-averse household, there's many different households who will respond to this information by moving inland, by summering in, by choosing a different city to live in, whether it's Fargo instead of living in a St. Louis, by moving out of flood zones. If you live in a flood zone, demanding a home with better materials. Folks, when I presented this at UC Santa Barbara, they said, you're giving people a lot of credit for rationality. I said, be careful. There's something called the insurance industry. Lloyd's of London and the other major insurers are publishing long papers about the future of insurance under climate change. Folks, if the risk of disaster goes up, what happens to your insurance premiums in a specific area at risk? They skyrocket. Seeing that price hike will lead a cost-minimizing household to change its behavior. So actually, the insurance industry and market signals play a very important role in changing people's behavior. It's not just Al Gore and the elite friends. Market capitalism can actually send useful signals of what is scarce and what is unsafe. Anticipating that crisis is at hand. I am a technological optimist when innovators are incentivized. If there are millions of desperate people, folks, what does that mean to a venture capitalist? Opportunity. How do venture capitalists get rich? Coming up with a product that people want. If climate change is causing a crisis, then there are huge returns to capitalists who can come up with low flush toilets, desalinization plants for water, renewable solar panels. All sorts of opportunities are actually opened up because of the imperative of climate change. And you might say, well, what's the probability they all fail? It's possible. But the very best idea, if 1,000 smart people are all thinking on an issue, can you really tell me that the maximum over 1,000 independent draws is going to be a small number? And so and that's the debate about technology. One more point. The next Google. All of us, all over the world, will be seeking these cures for climate change, techniques to help us mitigate the challenge. When there's a global market of people suffering, there's actually more opportunity for our capitalist entrepreneurs. They won't do this out of a Mother Teresa altruism. They'll do this out of self-interest and strong incentives. Folks, I'm down to 2 slides and I'll stop. Government. Everything I've said so far has been free market optimism. My book has a nasty chapter in it about government. And I have very fond feelings for government. I'm a public employee. I hope I continue to be. But let me tell you a story. Suppose that our family lives in New Orleans, and we know after Katrina that that climate change is going to trigger more intense storms and more of these. Suppose that the government sends over some handsome engineers who say, don't worry, people, we've built the mother of all seawalls. Lulling. Paul is yawning at lulling. Me and my family might believe that with this good seawall that we face no risk. And thus, an unintended consequence of government protecting an area is you actually put more people at risk. Suppose that Milton Friedman were our president, and he said, I'm not getting a dime of public money for any seawalls. You property owners want a seawall, build it yourself. Suppose the government did not spend a dime on seawalls. What would the populace of New Orleans do? Move to higher ground, and when the inevitable storm occurs, less damage. And so there's very interesting game theoretic strategy issues using very basic game theory from economics that government, even though it's well-intended, can have the unintended consequence of making climate change more costly because if its actions lull the public into putting themselves at risk. And this is what I mean by moral hazard. Moral hazard is the basic idea that if you know you have home insurance, you smoke in bed. And that's been or with these banks. If the banks on Wall Street know that they'll be bailed out because of too big to fail, they have an incentive to take excess risk. It's the same idea. Now, the book is very serious about my concerns in the developing world, in cities in the developing world, for how they'll cope with climate change. I'm well aware, and I talk at length about the science, much of it done at UCLA, on the challenges for poor urban people of flood risk, heat waves, water shortages, and the challenges the urban poor already face in the developing world in nations with low-quality, corrupt governments. The interesting issue here is, and this is easy for an economist to say, the best strategy for the urban poor in the developing world to protect themselves is to get richer. With extra income, you can eat better. Robert Fogel has done this work that when people could eat meat in 19th century America, that their bodies were able to withstand disease. And so private choices you make that a richer person is able to make can protect one against some of the public health threats and challenges that climate change will pose. But this is the weak link of the chapter, that climate change will, of the book, climate change will impose major costs on cities in the developing world. But if you want to protect those, look at the nation of South Korea and the progress it's made over the last 30 years. There are development success stories. And so there's a question of whether individuals can protect themselves when they have the resources. Final slide. I like this quote by Frank Knight, but I don't understand it. The existence of a problem of knowledge depends on the future being different from the past, while the possibility of a solution of the problem depends on the future being like the past. And so this quote fascinates me. When we know that we don't know what climate change will pose for us, what do we do? People are fundamentally risk-averse. We know this from the portfolios they hold in holding life insurance. When you know, after Richard's talk, and I know that not everyone on the planet has heard his talk, but there is a cognition out there of the known unknowns of climate change. But when we anticipate that there is ambiguous risks ahead, do we really just keep sailing along in our daily life? Or do we start to take the small steps to prepare and protect ourselves? And so I crack a joke here. Climate change adaptation is actually the ultimate test in modern economics between behavioral economists and neoclassical economists, of whom I'm one. Behavioral economists basically view us as Homer Simpson, and neoclassical economists view us as Mr. Spock from Star Trek. In the real world, I believe that we're a mixture of these two types, but here's my final point. Suppose the population is 2% Spocks and 98% Homer Simpsons who never see the iceberg before we hit it. Then there's actually huge opportunities for the Spocks to begin to innovate and come up with strategies to help Homer in the end game. Again, the floatable homes, the ability to generate renewable power, the water desalinization processes. And so you'd have to write down a model where all 100% of us are Homer Simpsons to begin to convince me that urbanites, and we have not talked about agriculture, we've not talked about biodiversity, everything I've talked about today has been how our cities will be affected in our hotter future. For me to bet on the pessimism that our cities are doomed in the face of climate change, we have to be an undiverse society where we're solely these Homer Simpsons. Let me stop there. Thank you.